Hello and welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Tony and Jamie, and we are here to talk about a whole manner of media, whether it's today it's going to be books, it's going to be video games, it's going to be graphic novels. In the past, we've talked about movies and music. And so the way we like to do things is first, each of us talks about one thing that we really enjoyed over the past week or two, and then we're all going to have a group discussion. This time it's going to be about Ready Player One, the book that's soon to be a movie by Steven Spielberg. So, Tony, you're going to go first. Tony, what would you like to talk about today?
Thanks, Dave. I'd like to talk about Private Eye. It's a graphic novel by Brian K. Vaughan, and the artist is Marcos Martin. It's a very visually stimulating graphic novel set in a post-internet future, maybe 100 years in the future, where the cloud and everything that we associate with the internet that we take for granted in our everyday lives today has burst. And all of that information has leaked, and it has caused a lot of problems. People losing jobs, people's families falling apart, and it's a very well-fleshed-out world because this guy is a private eye. His name is Pi, P-I, and he digs up information about who people are behind their masks because everybody who is born into this world has the right at when they turn 18 to wear a mask. And so he's the kind of person that pries behind that and pries into people's pasts and things like that. And so it's a pretty awesome, kind of very dark crime investigative story, but then it also is very flashy and the art's really like Blade Runner and meets, I don't know, the other one by Brian K. Vaughan that I liked a lot, Saga, is just very colorful, this one, because people are wearing, you know, like tiger masks and hollow suits to change the way that they look completely and, you know, camouflage in. So the police are synonymous in many ways with the press. They're called the press. And they, if you are caught, they'll be interviewed on camera and everything will become public. The news will leak via TV is still a big thing, and the news will leak on papers and things like that. So yeah, so it's a very interesting take on a sci-fi world that, like I was saying, is a really good mystery, but it builds into kind of a larger plot. And it's very gripping from page one. I liked it all the way through.
So is privacy the main goal that people have in this world? Is that the reason for the masks? Or
I think it is privacy. It's the society that's post-internet because they've learned that privacy is actually really important. And it's not even that you, if you have anything to hide, it's more the fact that that could be used against you in some way, in some foreseeable instance. And of course, there are still people out there that are trying to do mass surveillance. And that's kind of part of what the case that this PI is working into. He's kind of trying to thwart the efforts of this one kind of party, outside party, trying to do that. So private, and they do comment on it, and there's a lot of good philosophy of maybe why privacy is really important, but it's kind of written in subtle ways or at different points, kind of almost as a joke. And then the other really kind of neat thing that happens is there's a lot of communication that takes place through these archaic devices that we're used to. So they're like, I've never seen an iPhone that looks like that. And then there's like a guy who's his grandfather. He's like, that's not an iPhone, that's a Zune. And it's like, it's like there's like encrypted messages through that. So like people use these old technologies to still send messages in different ways. So it's a very thoughtful book, and it definitely plays on the fact that everything is just so, you know, ubiquitous now. All this technology is everywhere, and our interconnectivity is at a point where it's never been, and we all take it for granted maybe. So
sure. So I love Brian K. Vaughan, so I'm definitely interested in this book. Is it funny? Are there characters that are funny? Are the characters kind of that same easygoing, sarcastic?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, as Saga, yeah. The characters definitely, even though it is kind of, like I was saying, dark and gritty and has a lot of violence, the characters are very resilient, but they're also really funny to crack a joke in times of like despair or danger. I mentioned his grandpa, who's they just call Gramps, is really funny because he thinks the internet's still there. So he'll be playing a game and being like, why can't anyone connect to my server? What's going on? You know, you know, so he's kind of living in this nostalgic past, which is our present. And then even the main character is, there's a lot of surprises in there about who is he, you know, like obviously he's looking into other people's past, but who's his past? And it's like, no one really knows anybody. So
That sounds fascinating. So that's The Private Eye by Brian K. Vaughan. And that's just, it's not a series, right? It's just a one big book.
Right, yes. And I got this through ILL. It was in the library system. So you can place a hold on it. Or you can, I think you can even find it online on something called panelsyndicate.com. You can even do, it's like a pay what you want model. So
oh, okay.
You can find it online and just read it. So,
all right. Well, thank you, Tony. I'm up next, and I'm going to talk about a mobile game called Clash Royale. And this is a very interesting experience for me because this is from the makers of Clash of Clans, which is a wildly popular mobile game. And I've kind of, you know, smirked at these games in the past, like, you know, all these games aren't for me. I like real video games. These are fake video games. And
what's the difference between a real and a fake video game to that's, you, out of curiosity?
That's an excellent question. I don't want to be hateful in my consideration of this genre. What I feel about a lot of popular mobile games, including mm-hmm. this very game, is that it's engineered to extract as much money out of the person as possible. And that's priority number one. And then everything else comes second. Okay. The gameplay, the graphics, the sound, mm-hmm. all that comes second to what is the business model? How do we make it effective?
Okay.
So I don't know if it's real or if it's fake. It's a video game, you know. It's there's dragons and archers and knights, so that may, it's mm-hmm. a video game. So I finally got suckered into this one, and it turns out it's really good. Like, there's no ifs or ands or buts. It's just a really good game. It is still engineered to extract as much money out of you as it possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
That's still there. But the game itself is good. So the way it works is you're a king with your little castle, and then you've got two towers on either side of the castle. And you play against a live opponent. It is real PvP.
Nice.
It's not asymmetrical or anything like that. And they have a castle and they have two towers. And you're going to summon soldiers. Some are monsters, some are humans, some are giants, some mm-hmm. are a whole assortment of minions and creatures to assault the other guy. And if you destroy their castle, you win. Or if time runs out, and time on these games are only like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. Wow. If time runs out, then it's who destroyed more of the other person's towers.
Okay.
So you can win, you know, 2 towers to 1, or you could destroy both towers and a castle, or 1 tower, 1 castle, however you end up doing it. So it's kind of like tower defense, if you know what that means. A tower defense game is where you build towers that fight off these endless waves of enemies coming at you. This is kind of the opposite, mm-hmm. where the tower's already there and you're building the endless waves to mm-hmm. go after your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different creatures. You can only bring 8 into a battle. You can't use all of them. So you build a little deck or a little team that you fight with. And the other guy may have the same, may have different. You mm-hmm. don't know until you're in the fight. And there's layers of balance where, you know, if you've got a melee guy coming at you, you want to build archers that can shoot him before he can get there. Or you want to build a flying unit because a melee guy can't reach. If you build a baby dragon, the baby dragon can shoot fire at him and there's nothing he can do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's balance like that, and there's balance in the terms of there's AoE attacks, and then there's one strong character with a lot of armor, or 10 little skeletons with no armor, and so, oh, he built skeletons, so I should build a bomber because that'll kill more guys, but now he's built a musketeer to counter my bomber, so I should build minions to counter his musketeer,
mm-hmm.
and the game goes on, and you push back and forth until time runs out. And either someone wins or time runs out, however you have to win.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun. It's really interesting. I've played a lot of serious PvP games, and this is right up there among them. The difficulty is you level up your minions. They get stronger and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
The more chests you open, and chests, you win by winning a game.
Okay.
But you open them either by paying money or by waiting. 3 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, you say, I'm going to open this chest. And the game says, all right, come back in 12 hours.
Okay.
Sure.
And maybe your stuff will level up, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the money comes in. If you're like, well, I want to play right now. I want to open this chest now. I want to play more. I want to, well, you can't unless right. you spend money to open the chest immediately. You play more, you get more chests. You open them immediately. You play more, you get more chests. Or you play like 2 games a day and then you have to forget about it and come back the next day and play some more and then mm-hmm. forget about it and come back the next day. And that's really hard to do because it's a sincerely fun game.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely engineered to extract as much money out of me as possible. It is absolutely evil. It is cruel. It yeah. is sinister, but it's really good.
How is it different than Clash of Clans?
So Clash of Clans is a different gameplay where you're assaulting another guy's towers and they're not there. This one is live.
Like, okay.
You connect to a game, and I am playing against another person. Mm-hmm. And you can even send emotes and things like that. You can say, hello, good game, well played. Mm-hmm. Your king can make funny faces, like where he looks angry or he looks happy or something like that.
There's more communication involved.
Absolutely.
What was the moment that you realized that the challenge of beating someone or the satisfaction of beating someone, like, did you at first approach it skeptically or did you realize, like, right away that this is a pretty well-balanced game? Like, how long would it take to get into if I picked it up?
At least a couple of days before things get interesting, because the more you play, the more variety of minions you unlock. So in the beginning, it's the same minions. My minions and your minions are the same. We haven't unlocked anything new. Mm-hmm. But from there, there's still strategy there because, like I say, like you can build musketeers, you can build archers, you can build knights, and you can build skeletons, and those all counter each other in different ways. Then as you get up further, then it's a variety of minions. And that's when you have to start thinking about, all right, what is my AoE attacker? What is my high armor attacker? What is my, how am I going to destroy castles? Is it giants or is it hot air balloons? You know, you have to decide your plan of attack.
Cool.
I really like it a lot. I was playing it this morning. I was playing it yesterday. I'm going to play it again tonight and tomorrow, I'm sure. But it's hard for me to recommend. If you have a lot of patience or a lot of money, you will enjoy this game a lot.
How much money do you have to pay to open the chest?
It depends. So, like, little chests can be under a dollar. Bigger chests will be more money. I have paid no money so far.
Okay.
I have not paid a cent. It's all been what I've earned in-game and what I've had the patience to wait for. So it's hard for me to comment on how much money feels effective because it's not really like buying something accomplishes something. It's not like, all right, I've spent $5 and now I've gotten all these new things. Mm-hmm. $5 basically buys you one less day of waiting, and $10 buys you two less days of waiting. And so then it doesn't feel like paying money really accomplishes anything because it's like, oh, I just, like, I would have had these things tomorrow. Why did I pay $5 today? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. It's very well designed. My hat's off to the people who made the game. But I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to be playing it because it rations itself in a way that I don't find enjoyable. I'll play two games or three games, have a lot of fun, and then I'm forced to put my phone away. And I don't like that at all.
Okay.
So that's Clash Royale. It's available Android and iPhone. It's available for download for free. I recommend trying it. I recommend playing it. But don't get your hopes up because sooner or later that horror will kick in. The evil greed of these terrible game companies making fake games will catch up with you. But I hope to play games like this in the future because this is a really good one. Or I hope that maybe years into the model, maybe it'll change a little bit because it is a good game. All right, so that's my little half rant, half praise for Clash Royale. Jamie, you're up next, and you're talking about a book. What are you talking about today?
I'm talking about the book The Past by Tessa Hadley, and it came out late last year to pretty wide acclaim. And I listened to it actually on audiobook because the audiobook was available free on the streaming service Hoopla. And the story itself seems pretty small or, I guess, quotidian because it's about this British family and their domestic trials, I guess. It's about four adult siblings, a brother and three sisters, as they're trying to figure out what to do about their grandparents' old summer home that's out in the country. It's this big, if you think of the epitome of like British old country houses, it's this big structure that's kind of crumbling and falling down. And now that their parents are both dead, they're trying to figure out whether they should continue to stay in this house and pay for its upkeep or to sell it. And so this is the family's last hurrah, trying to stay in this place and figure out what to do about it. And it's essentially just about the relationships between the four siblings and their own children. And the world seems pretty small as it's set up initially. The conflicts that we deal with are like one of the sisters is starting to have romantic feelings towards her brother's new wife, or one of the stepsons is starting to, you know, have feelings towards one of the cousins, or the kids find a dead dog, a neighbor's dead dog in a nearby cottage. So they all kind of seem very relational, and, you know, the world isn't far-reaching or expansive. But the way that Hadley writes about it makes these domestic concerns seem really chilling in a way. And I think because we're set against this backdrop of this crumbling building, there's this kind of gothic pallor kind of going over the whole story. And especially the children, she writes really well. The children of one of the sisters are about 6 and 8 years old, a brother and a sister, and we get to see a lot of the world through their eyes. And the world through their eyes is very sinister, which I think is interesting, especially in children. I think it's hard to write really young kids well without making them seem really precocious or really sweet, but their dynamic was really fascinating. Mm. And through their imaginative play, we see that they have these creepy stories about these women that they make up mm-hmm. and think inhabit the neighbor's cottage. And when they find this dead dog, the corpse of a rotting dead neighbor's dog, they keep that secret to themselves. And they don't tell it to anyone else. They don't tell any of the adults. And the older sister, who's 8, tells them, like, don't tell anyone. The women will get you. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of see how the secrets that they're all keeping from each other, the adults kind of are reflected in that. But I think the children's dynamic was what interested in me most, and how creepy the world of kids can be, or the imaginative mm-hmm. worlds of kids.
It sounds awesome. Yeah, that, just referring to that reminds me of, like, stories that kids would, you know, you pass between friends, or, you know, I had brothers. So it's like just like the types of stories that creep you out, that make you not want to necessarily talk to adults or not want to dig any deeper. So like there is something beneath the surface or something that's lurking there. So that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it definitely seems like they felt like they had to keep secrets from the adults to protect the adults. Like they can't know about this, which is the reverse of what we usually think about children. But I think I've definitely been reading a lot more of gothic type of literature lately. And so this was interesting that it's contemporary, it takes place now, but it definitely has this like creepy, sinister mood going over it, even though most of the stuff is very domestic, I think.
Yeah, fear seems to be, in what you're describing, a theme in like the children are afraid of the woman. Mm-hmm. That's a very clear fear. One that, you know, maybe we've all had towards an adult who did or did not exist, mm-hmm. who's scary looking or has a scary looking house, and so you assume things about them. But then you're talking about the adults having secrets, mm-hmm. and they're mm-hmm. keeping these secrets out of fear as well. Fear yeah. of making someone angry or making someone feel hurt.
Mm-hmm. They definitely have a lot of their own anxieties. The new wife doesn't want to tell her husband about her own family's problems because she doesn't want to put too much stress on him. So she'll tell her sister-in-law, who then, because of these secrets that she's the only one that's being told, starts to feel this romantic connection towards her own sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. So we kind of see through the dynamics of all the adults, like, they have anxieties or fears towards one of the people, so they'll confess in another sibling. Mm-hmm. So we kind of have this interconnected tangle of relationships that all have to do with them hiding things from some siblings, but then revealing them to others. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something that all readers can relate to. And it's definitely very British. And the audiobook reading, the narrator, I forget her name right now, she does a great job of illuminating all the different characters without having it seem like so, you know, some narrators are just very overt and the characters are just so overdone that mm-hmm. it's painful to listen to. But here it's subtle, but each character definitely has their own distinct personality and voice.
It makes me wonder kind of where the fear came from, who had it first. Did the children learn anxiety from watching the adults, or did the adults have anxiety as children, and then as they grow up, they have it still? And it's all about, you know, secrets at different ages mm-hmm. are going to be experienced mm-hmm. in different ways, but still, mm-hmm. like, it's the same fear, it's the same anxiety throughout your life, whether it's fear of a boogie monster or it's mm-hmm. fear of something potentially very real, such as, you know, an unexpected attraction.
Mm-hmm. A short middle passage in the book goes back to the further past, and it talks about their grandmother, so the adult's mother, who died unexpectedly. And it talks about her own troubles because she took all her own children, who are the adults in the book, and they ran away from her own husband at one point and camped out at the grandmother's house. So okay. this like ramshackle house. So even though that's only a short chapter in the book, it definitely shows how the children, who we see later as adults, kind of get their neuroses or anxieties or pick them up from their mother. And I think the title, The Past, aptly describes how sequences that happen to your own parents or your own grandparents mm-hmm. definitely change your personalities or your identities and then mm-hmm. kind of weave their way through next generations. And then, you know, this house that's falling down all around them is kind of the setting where this all takes place. So I think if you're interested in family dynamics and relationships, you know, if you're an Anglophile, it would be good too, because the Britishness definitely seeps its way through. Or in the lives of children, I think it would be a good one to read. I definitely enjoyed it, even though at the beginning I was a little unsure about it because the world just seemed so small, like tucked up in this one family, in this one house. But the way that Hadley psychologically examines each of these characters, I found fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sounds really good.
Okay, our final discussion. This one we've been talking about for a long time. It's going to be interesting. We're going to discuss Ready Player One, which is a book by Ernest Cline. It's going to be made into a movie by Steven Spielberg soonish. They haven't started filming yet, but I think there's casting news out there. So it's going to reach a much wider audience soon. We'll start with Tony. Tony, how do you feel about Ready Player One?
Yeah, it's been a while since I read it, so I'm sorry if I don't get all the details like spot on. But it really did stick with me, and I really liked it. I give it my shining review and endorsement because it has a certain charm to it, I think, in its simplicity. I mean, I think it's just a very linear book once you look back on it. But while you're going through it, it's a very fun ride, and it's colorful. I mean, this is a book about let me just do a quick overview of the book. It is about a future society where the internet and a video game are kind of synonymous. So like the MMORPG of today, the massively multiplayer online game, like World of Warcraft, for example, and the internet are kind of the same thing. So everybody and their mother and brother and sister, they all have virtual reality headset goggles, and they all control their avatars. And they're basically living, because of the fall of, I guess, modern economy, they're all living through that avatar. And that's kind of their well-being, and that's their escapism. And it's kind of how everybody finds their new life, I guess, in a certain way. Whereas like kind of the rest of the world in reality is kind of decaying or in a state of, I don't know, economic poverty, I guess.
I remember there were like flight to the cities, people searching for just a place to live and just ending up living in their cars because there's nowhere to go.
Trailer parks like stacked on top of each other because, you know, you just have to move up because you can't move out anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the real world seemed pretty horrible.
Right. And what this game offered, once the creator of this game died, he willed his estate kind of like Willy Wonka to the first person who could find this Easter egg and discover the path to unlock the secret code. You know, it's like, so essentially a game within a game. And it is the main character and a bunch of these other individuals and evil corporate organizations that are trying to unlock that code and beat that game within this game in order to win the fortune and, you know, win this person's inheritance and win the game world itself. So the simplicity behind it, I really liked the references to 80s culture, and there's a bunch of them. So, you know, if you're a fan of any of those shows, or you actually, chances are it's going to be referencing something that you're a fan of already, because there's just, it's kind of referencing a lot of things that are like the underpinning of a lot of nerd culture. So for those reasons, I liked it. I just really identified with it right away, and it's a really easy read. And if you don't read that many books, this is one of the types of books that you can just like plow through because it's simple and fun and upbeat, but also has like a story that just kind of advances quickly. So
on the flip side of that, Dave, I want to hear your take about that.
I hated this book. I started listening to the audiobook.
Will Wheaton
read the audiobook, and he did a good job, but I did not like this book. I listened to the audiobook as long as I could, and then I got so mad about this book that I said, I have to finish this book. This audiobook is going too slow. So I checked it out from the library, and I was up all night reading this book, hating page after page, just to be done with it. Because I tried to just stop, and I couldn't stop, because I said, this, it can't be. This couldn't be this. Could that be that? The plot is as cliched as plots come. The references are fun and funny. I will absolutely give it that. It is all about the references. There are TIE fighters. There is the Starship Enterprise. There are lightsabers and Matthew Broderick, 16 candles, and anything from the 80s. It's not just nerd stuff. It's also just bands and movies. And if you enjoy those, you might enjoy the way they're shouted out in this book. But what I didn't like about them is that they were just simplistic. They were too obvious. It's just like, here's a TIE fighter, and then he would just move on. Like, there's not a joke there. Mm-hmm. There's no implication there. It's just like, hey, I said the word TARDIS. Mm-hmm. Isn't that cool?
So it kind of seemed like it's like a bunch of hashtags, like shout outs to people who are into that.
And then the plot was the plot to Star Wars with a different setting, one could say. If you have read the book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which no one has, I'm sure I haven't, but there is a theory that George Lucas kind of codified in Star Wars, which is different cultures have different stories, and these stories all seem to have a lot of the same themes or ideas. Mm-hmm. The monomyth is the idea that what if we could take all these different ideas, all these different cultures, and all these different stories, and put them into one big story, what would it look like? And the book describes the 17 steps of the monomyth, the hero's journey. You may mm-hmm. have heard these terms before. And this book is 100% top to bottom, step by step, the monomyth plot. Our hero has to leave his home behind. He meets an ally. He meets an enemy. He meets another ally. He is seduced by a woman. He is given the gift of the goddess. He enters the belly of the beast. You could name these things before they happened. And I found that insufferable to know where this is going and know why it's happening.
I felt similarly about that reading, but I think a lot of stories go through that monomyth, but do so even though they're following these set of tropes. The way that they're told is unique or compelling in a way. So even though the story is the same story, because I think so many stories are similar to that, I'm engaged by something else. There's something else to connect to, whether it's the depth of the character or because the setting is unique. So even though the plot points are all the same, I'm still engaged by it.
Yes.
But I think in this one, I had difficulty because you said it's a Tony, you were talking about how it's a really easy, like, fast read. Mm-hmm. And it is a really easy fast read. But I think there was a clunkiness to the prose. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily going back to what you were talking about, Dave, where I felt like a lot of the references were just kind of thrown in there, or a lot of the plot points weren't fleshed out fully, where the scene setup wasn't developed enough to make me feel like, oh, like I'm invested in all of these characters, or I'm invested in this world, where it all just seemed like the story was told to me kind of like Klein was reading off bullet points or something. Mm-hmm. The prose was boxy to me, I mm-hmm. guess. And that made it difficult for me to get into because it didn't seem like there is any nuance. It just seemed like a Mad Libs type of book mm-hmm. where things were just like plopped in here and there.
Yeah, so going back to that point, the monomyth is perfectly acceptable if the plot is not the center of the story, mm-hmm. if the center of the story is something else. In Star Wars, it's very much the characters. It's this mm-hmm. relationship between Luke, Leia, and Han, as well as the lovable characters around them, 3PO and Chewbacca mm-hmm. and all that. I don't care if it's a tired plot because I'm invested in these characters. I want to watch these characters. I want to watch how they interact, what they mean to each other. This book, like, the characters are just, I'm friends with you, and we have a lot of fun being friends together. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I have a girlfriend for the first time, and it's a little overwhelming. And it's like, yeah, that's, you know, that's nothing new. Mm-hmm. I think this book tries to make its center 80s culture, but there's no heart there. There's no meaning there. Mm-hmm. It's just like, look at this, look at this, look at this. Like,
there's no depth to it. Right. Yeah.
They had the character reenact War Games mm-hmm. and quote every line. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they had the character play Pac-Man and
have to get a perfect score.
Mm-hmm. The reason people watched War Games is not to quote the movie. The reason people play Pac-Man is not to get a perfect score. They mm-hmm. just have fun doing these things.
Right.
And this character kind of didn't have fun doing these things, just was proud to be good at them. Mm-hmm. It's very strange to me. I also, like, I feel bad hating this book so much. I really hate it a lot, but I don't want to, I'm not particularly upset with the author. It's his first book, and God bless him, everyone says, write about what you know, mm-hmm. and he certainly did. He wrote about what he knew, and he kept it simple, and he had huge success, and good for him, but I think somehow that kind of feeds my, like, how furious I am every time it comes up. Oh, Steven Spielberg's mm-hmm. hiring someone new. And I'm like, not this book again. I want this to be over. I want it to be gone.
It feels like it's a right time kind of book where, like, we're at the place in culture where video games have become, all the people who grew up with games finally have the ability to fully endorse video game culture, and it's just blowing up as a business and as an industry and everything sure. like that. And, like, Ready Player One comes out, what, mm-hmm. 5-6 years ago, and at seemingly the perfect time.
Right.
And everybody jumps on it because it's not just for teens, even though it's maybe like more of a YA book. It's everybody loves it. And,
well, that confuses me as well, because it's often sold as a YA book. It's sold to teens, but teens don't get the 80s references, do they? Like, who is this book for?
Is it like nostalgia purposes? Like for the people who were really invested in these things at that time?
Or is it for people, you know, if I've never read a monomyth book before, then I'm going to love this book because it's my first exposure to it. And I can understand that. Maybe it's meant to be for both and it kind of delivers to neither. I'm not really sure.
Because in some ways it feels like, you know, that one friend of yours who, you know, spouts all these references to prove something about himself. And then there is a character like that in the book. I think his name is Irak, who does that. And Wade calls him out as being a poser.
Yeah.
But then, again, if the book is kind of fulfilling the same type of thing, are the people who were really invested in this specific culture in the 80s at the time, like, is reading this book, would they think like, oh, like, I get all of this, like, this is something, or does it seem like a poser type of book because it's not the depth, I guess, like you were saying, is not there?
Yeah, I think it's morally bankrupt that these children and these people spend their whole lives trying to be someone else, and one of them gets $1 trillion for it, and everyone else just... They've taken on this personality, this culture that instead of developing their own, and that's kind of awful. I wonder if maybe that's a redeeming quality or is that a condemning quality? What is that the point? Is that, you know, when the real world dies, the virtual world is stuck in the 80s forever? Like, if maybe I shouldn't be so quick to judge it, but I don't think that is the author's intention.
Yeah,
I think I'm just trying to find something that I like about this book. And
well, I think, I mean, to a certain extent, it is like so much of it was based in nostalgia that I think you're right in saying a little bit that maybe the reason I liked this book so much was because I was living through my brothers while they were playing and watching these things. And it's almost like it's the younger generation connecting with the generation before it when they read it and trying to find out the things that they liked and inspired this, you know, generation of games and media and et cetera. But I don't know.
If you're a young adult right now, let's say like you're like 18 right now, you wouldn't have any attachment to those things. You know, like you wouldn't have any exposure really.
I guess you're right. I mean,
to a lot of them, like, you know, TIE fighters are forever, but like war games, like Matthew Broderick,
that doesn't necessarily mean anything. There's no connection there. Because I think if that person decided to go and watch War Games today, I guess is a thing. Because, like, I was getting some of my cultural education from this book. I won't lie. Like, I hadn't seen War Games before it, which maybe that's a horrible thing. But this was, you know.
Yeah.
But even though I, you know, I could say I'm a student of the 80s and Nintendo and all that stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like it's a good record for that type of thing. It does connect you to that era, which is the foundation to a lot. And I wanted to mention that a lot of time nerds... Like, the way that people are coming up with games today is just a whole lot of ripping off what was yesterday and just, I really liked this idea, and I'm just going to try to do it again in my way and make it my own. So I don't know if the book really accomplishes that or even says that, but I think maybe that's in my reading of my experience of it. I got the feeling of, I'm actually kind of being educated by what inspired, you know, the last generation maybe, so...
Yeah, and I can understand if it does provide a connection to that time, if you enjoy that. Like, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I want to be clear, like, I hate this book. I don't hate the author. I don't hate the fans of this book. I kind of...
Disclaimer.
I might look forward to the movie, because I like Spielberg movies a whole lot. And if he actually gets the license to all these properties, that'd be kind of amazing. Like, I watched Wreck-It Ralph just because they got a lot of licenses. I don't know. Will Wheaton's read-through, every character was brutally sarcastic. I don't know if that's on the author, if that's on the reader, or if that's on both, but I could not stand it. It had to stop. And I've listened to him read... Red Shirts, and I enjoyed that very much, so I don't think it's Will Wheaton's fault. I think it's maybe some kind of, you know, 1+1=-1 here. It's Will Wheaton and Ernest Cline. Put them together, and it just comes across. Like, I would just feel bad in the car, because, like, you know, there's horrible things these people are saying to each other, and they're bickering. And
I had an easier time listening to the audiobook, actually, than the book. Because I think the prose bothered me so much. And in the audiobook reading, it wasn't as, like, discernible to me.
Right.
Which is maybe, like, I think I'll enjoy the movie because the clunkiness of it was what bothered me so much. And then in a movie, I mean, it's not going to be written out in words, obviously. So I think having all those references and stuff be visual rather than written will be a different experience.
And Will Wheaton is an interesting reader because he's an actor by trade. So he's very active. He's very into, I want to create voices for all of these characters, as opposed to a lot of readers, which are just kind of putting the prose out there for you to take in. Maybe that's why it was more enjoyable for you, because you had some additional character as opposed to just the text.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the text was the part where I was like really struggling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When Armada came out and everyone hated it, I was kind of relieved. I felt like
like finally justified.
Like I was the one saying the Emperor has no clothes, and everyone else finally caught on. Every negative review I read about Armada describes how I feel about Ready Player One. It was kind of spooky. Armada, the second book, is still very much, it's The Last Starfighter, but in a novel form. And people are like, oh, there's references thrown in for just no reason. I'm like, yeah, that's what I've been saying, but...
Sure.
So anyway, I do not recommend this book. Tony, I think you do recommend this book.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I still do. But I think you guys have really good points on... I wouldn't go back and necessarily reread it, but I might sample the Will Wheaton version after a while. We'll see.
I would recommend this to a specific group of people. Like, I have a 17-year-old cousin who, when I was reading this, I was like, oh, I will recommend this to him. He will love it. So I think if you're a certain type of person who enjoys certain types of things, I would tell you to read it, but not in general.
Yeah, I don't know. It might just be me or it might just be my experience. I had person after person tell me, you got to read this book. You got to read this book. And I'm like, all right, fine, I'll read this book. And I'm like, what do these people think of me? But yeah, controversial here on the podcast. Ready Player One is out. It's been out for a long time in book form and audiobook form. It sounds like we've, as a group, have enjoyed and not enjoyed both the book and the audiobook, so whichever you prefer. And I'm looking forward to the movie. I'm interested in the movie's development.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about the movie on the podcast. We'll say that. If the podcast still exists by then.
For years to come. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that sounds like it for Ready Player One, and that sounds like it for the Pint and Click podcast. We'll see you next time.